This episode of the Sportsman's Empire is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. Since 1952, Interstate Batteries has been evoking compassion and a trustworthy spirit into the surrounding communities. Interstate Batteries is a mission-driven company fueled by purpose and guided by their values. If you need help locating a specific battery, stop into your local Interstate Batteries retail store and speak with a battery specialist. They even offer cell phone repairs. Interstate Batteries. Outrageously dependable. All right, everybody, this is the Hunting Gear Podcast. I'm your host, Dan Johnson. If this is your first time ever, thank you very much for coming and listening to two awesome dudes talk about hunting gear and equipment. Today's guest is Mr. Justin Hunold. Justin, how are we doing, dude?
Good. How are you, Dan?
I'm doing good, man. What we're going to do today is the same thing that we do every episode, and I'm just going to kind of kick it to you. I'm going to say, where do you live and what do you do for a living?
Sure. So I live in San Diego, California, and I am a, so for my living, I work in the power sports industry. I work for the largest power sports auction company in the world, and I'm the interface, so the like program director for our interactions and in relationships with major OEMs, so like Harley Davidson, Honda, BRP, stuff like that. And then kind of my side gig, the thing I've built for about the past 6 years, is I concentrate on like content for hunting, fishing, and outdoor companies, carry conceal, EDC, stuff like that. And I've been doing that for about 6 years. And that comes with a lot of partnerships in this space. And kind of a little bit of background is, you know, I live here in San Diego, but I'm a passionate whitetail hunter. So I travel out east a ton to hunt and get ready for the season, do some scouting, stuff like that. And then vice versa, I live sort of that mountain western hunting life on this coast here and do some traveling around the west for that. Great fishing here in San Diego, all that stuff. And really enjoy sort of the travel hunting aspect of this life.
Yes, my friend. And that is why you are here today. I always like to ask this question to the people who live in California. A couple questions actually is, when you talk to other people in San Diego, because when I hear San Diego or LA or San Francisco or Sacramento, I don't think hotspot for hunters. Okay.
Right.
What's it like living in a state where like you might be the only one hunter in 10,000 people?
Right. So that statistic's probably actually accurate. If you pan it out, you know, you take nationwide and then drop it down, what we sit statistically as hunters nationwide versus population of San Diego. So that's, you're probably pretty accurate with that math. So it's interesting because you kind of find your community, right? So at first it was like Ducks Unlimited, Backcountry Hunters, whatever I could find as far as organizations that I either belong to or have, you know, cohabitated with, so to speak, and kind of get sticky with all that and volunteer and do some work there. Oddly enough, my best hunting buddy here, I met at Sportsman's Warehouse, and he was the hunting manager at the time. And he helped me get my first, when I first moved here, I had to get an out-of-state license because I hadn't had residency established. So I started there. But hunting here, there's a lot of opportunity. There's a ton of small game hunting. As far as California draws, you're guaranteed a deer tag in the state. So you still have draws in their zones, but you're guaranteed a deer tag. You can draw a bighorn tag after some years of attempting. You can draw a pronghorn tag after some years. You can draw a elk tag after some years or an elk tag after some years. We do have like wild pigs, so that's county dependent, but it's year round statewide. There's no season. So you can do that. You can get two bears a year here now. It was one bear. And then I, you know, like a pretty interesting statistic I would say is the fact that, a few years ago, at least California led the nation in, federal duck stamp sales. So there is a lot of duck hunting in California.
Right.
Cause if people picture, much to your point, you picture San Diego, LA, you know, maybe Bakersfield and head up towards Sacramento, and then you get to San Francisco and you're just picturing the big cities on the coast, with the exception of Sacramento's not on the coast, but you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And that's really, yeah, that's a chunk of it. Right. And that's the coastal region, but there's a huge chunk of the state that is like just wild. And I mean, like there's nothing there. The people that live there live a very sort of like agriculture based or you know, outdoor based life, and there's a lot of opportunity. So I actually live closer here. So I lived outside of Philadelphia, kind of where a lot of the hunting folks that we hear from all the time live, same general area. And I had to drive about an hour to get to the closest public land to hunt in Pennsylvania. Yeah. To the point that I started hunting in New Jersey because it was way closer.
Yeah.
And here it's about 40 minutes and I can be on 100,000 acres of BLM and, you know, scouting for deer, and you got to share it with horse riders and backpackers just like you do anywhere else. But yeah, you got to find your tribe, but they definitely exist. We're here. Yeah. And a good place also to kind of take it down the path there of finding people to do that with, or that you share a like-mindedness with, is the fishing community here is huge. So
yeah,
it's a fishing town and it's a military town. So
yeah,
well, very often, again, San Diego, you think like it's just south of LA. Well, it takes a while to get down here. It's about 4 hours on a rough drive. It's a couple hours if it's not, but we are a military town. So you do get a lot of folks coming in who have a ton of outdoor experience and enjoy being outside. Right. And that's part of that. So,
yeah. Yep. So talk to me a little bit about, I'm interested in the travel aspect of all of this.
Sure.
Right. So you are traveling. Are you, when you go to Kansas and when you go to New York to hunt whitetails, are you going all the way by plane? You driving? How are you doing that?
So I have not been, I hunt in Colorado a couple times. I've not been to Kansas since I've been here. So I just drew that tag. So I will drive to Kansas. It's about 22 hours. So I'm meeting some family members there for the rifle hunt, and they are going to drive from New York, and that's about 22 hours as well. So it's equidistant. But when I go to New York or Ohio, because I do both those trips every year, I head from San Diego. I jump on an airplane. I fly to my cousin's house. Well, I fly to Syracuse, drive to my cousin's house. I'll typically rent a car at this point. And he's kind enough to store about, I don't know, the normal passionate whitetail hunter's amount of gear that I have is sitting in the corner of his garage right now. So I do have like a home base there, and I'm able to like fly in and get all that together and then proceed to hunt from there. But we're hunting buddies. Like he's not just my cousin. He's like my best friend. So we spend a ton of time together. We talk all the time, and I'm able to do that. And he's nice enough to let me do that. Occasionally I got to throw him some gear here and there and do some different stuff, but it's just more a thank you than it is anything else. And then from here, so take all that stuff that you probably have at your house and all of us probably have at our house. Now multiply that times two, cause I also house that in California, for all we do out here. Now it's a little less intensive of like tree stands and saddles and sticks and stuff like that. I might have one set out here. Big boy backpacks, big boy tents, all the mountain hunting stuff that you'd have, backcountry hunting stuff you'd have. Yeah. And then I do travel. Typically, I left a rifle with him in New York so I could gun hunt out there. And I take my bow back and forth. Recently, I brought that rifle back because I may or may not take that one to Kansas. I have multiple, so I might take that one to Kansas. But
gotcha. What's some advice that you would give? Because I have never traveled. No, I take that back. One time I traveled with a bow on an airplane and I put it in, you know, I put it in my bow case. I had a lock on it. I even put some extra towels in it to help with the vibration or, you know, being dropped or whatever. Cause you see those videos of like the people who unload the airplanes just launching luggage.
Shit. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And so I put some extra towels in there to kind of absorb some of those blows. But I've never traveled with a firearm. What's that like?
So firearms, here's a piece of gear. Like first piece of gear I would go get if I'm anybody that doesn't have like a reasonable rifle case is oddly enough at Harbor Freight. They sell those Apache cases. Mm-hmm. That double rifle case from their Apache double rifle case is basically just like a Pelican. Mm-hmm. It has a pressure valve on it for flight. And it has locking points with wheels, and it's like $150 when it's on sale. So it's about half the price of a Pelican. And I've traveled all around the country with that thing. Mm-hmm. So as far as traveling with a firearm, it's actually pretty easy. I do suggest getting to your airport a little early, obviously, earlier than you would to fly generally, but basically you have to have, they can't pry the case open. So on that case, for instance, you have to have two locks. I have a TSA lock and then I have like another just padlock that I put on it. you get to check in your luggage. You go to the check station because you obviously have to check that big bag and they got to look at it. Your ammunition has to be separate. So we 3D printed in like ammo containers to have it separate from me. And then you can have the firearm in there unloaded with whatever. You know, I'll put my optics in there. So binocular spotting scope. And I'll put whatever knives I need in that same check bag. So that way I'm kind of minimizing it. If it's a bow, I do the same thing. Optics and knife go with it, but then I will put a lot of my hunting clothes to kind of fill that space up. But with a rifle specifically, I just put that stuff in there. Ammunition's in that case, but in its own separate sort of compartment. Mm-hmm. Just pop it open. They look at it, close it back up. I lock it, and then they send it down the conveyor belt. I have not had to go double check it like downstairs at TSA or wherever the TSA location is, but that's pretty simple. My only suggestion is at every airport is different. I would say out of a place like a major hub, they're pretty used to getting firearms through. At some of the smaller airports, maybe less depending on where it is, right? Like, you know, I would assume I've flown into Branson, Missouri for Bass Pro Shops stuff when I worked for them, and that they get firearms all constantly, right? Like, yeah, that's not a deal for them. But if you're in, I don't know, Syracuse, sometimes gets even a little sticky when I'm flying out of there. It feels different. So I generally get there about 45 minutes, an hour earlier than I would otherwise. And I kind of just accept that's part of it. And then with a bow, firearms, they keep very good track of. So rarely will you lose a gun in transit, right? But a bow, I get a little more like, how does this work? Where's it going to go?
Yeah.
So I use actually like an architect where they keep their plans. So like a paper tube, like a plastic tube. I put all my arrows in there. I do separate the broadheads out and they go in a separate basically case inside that case. And then my optics, my bow and all that stuff, they go in a very similar case. I had to order it off Amazon because when I measured everything out, they didn't make an Apache case that size, but it's basically the same thing. It's like a Pelican case. I have flown with one of those, you know, $30 special. You buy them generally by Plano, but they might be by somebody else at whatever big box retail place. I've flown with one of those. You strap it in. I would never do it again. The latches don't stay on. They're super flimsy. It's just like, it's $150 in most people's bows at this point. You're spending $2,000 to be on a, you know, flagship rig. So why would you not spend $150 on a case? So those are the two things. And traveling with archery gear is a little bit easier, I would say. People don't, there's not like the standoffishness you get at the counter sometimes that you get with a firearm.
Yeah. Like someone opens up and is like, oh my God. What is this? Yep. Are you going to bomb the plane or whatever? Yeah. So, cool, man. So what other, like, it seems to me like you have a process in place for a lot of this travel with, you know, cause you got two locations, one on East Coast, one on West Coast that are basically, you know, dump sites for all of your gear. Right.
Yeah.
And so when, like, let's say like when you go to Ohio or another state that's not New York, where all of your other gear is, are you flying in there, grabbing it and then driving to Ohio? Yeah. Okay.
Yep. So typically to your point of the systems, like I live and die by systems. Right. And I think that's pretty much the smartest way to go about most things in life. And when you're doing this much traveling and this much sort of work around the space, you need to be efficient with it. So what I'll do is when you're saying like a dump site, that's actually what it is. But for instance, I went out and turkey hunted and that's a nonsense trip. That's mostly deer scouting with a shotgun in my hand and hanging out with my family. I went to New York and did that. And, during that time, I just did like a double check when I dropped everything back off. I made sure everything was where it was supposed to be. The cases that I would take to Ohio, because I use those big Home Depot locking totes for all my clothes, just to keep them organized, to keep them safe against mice and stuff like that. All that stuff was organized. All the sticks and stands were together that had to go. And I can literally walk in and grab that stuff and put it. We take my cousin's truck to Ohio, so we drive together. And I just throw it in his truck. We throw the canoe on top and we head out. But it's just like being very deliberate about the way I store stuff, move stuff around, and keeping a constant sort of like, I keep a checklist in my phone of what's at each place, basically. So that way I know if I'm looking for something random, that's in New York. I try not to double up expensive things like optics, right? You only need one set and you travel back and forth with those. But at the same time, I I have extra over years of doing this. I have extras of everything. So I could potentially leave a full, bow and everything there, and then a full bow everything here.
Yeah.
I don't do that, but
yeah.
Yeah, those are just the pieces. The hunt essential pieces are kind of what fly with me and go with me trip to trip.
Okay. So when you say hunt essentials, boots, camo, that kind of stuff, and then
boots, weapon, optics. They're basically with me, for the most part. And then I leave like big rubber boots in New York for that, because we're, again, going to hunt swamps and stuff like that. So I'll leave those in New York. But I have like Salewas and Asolos and whatever. I'll decide which boots to wear. Even Keens, I'll decide which boots to wear on the trip, and I just wear those to the airport.
Gotcha.
Yeah. So when I try to hunt essentials, but other than that, the rest of it is all conjecture. You can use that whenever.
Gotcha. When it comes to your hunting style, are you hunting more with a firearm, or are you hunting more with a bow?
Way more with a bow.
Way more with a bow. Okay. All right. So. By the way, you're going to hear a lot of rain coming down here pretty soon. We've got a big storm moving in, and then we have a tin roof on our house. So you're going to hear a lot of rain here in the next couple minutes. Well, it's going to be here for a while. But anyway, what I'm getting at is when you're hunting in Southern California, 40 minutes away from your house for deer, is that like a tree stand environment, a run and gun environment, or is that more of a spot and stalk environment? All right, guys, you know me, and I love eating wild game, but I don't eat wild game every single night. Every once in a while, I'll reach for a side of beef, and that's why I trust Omaha Steaks. Because Omaha Steaks are sent directly to my door, I can keep my freezer stocked without having to go to the grocery store. It's honestly like having a trusted butcher and gourmet food shop right at your house. Last week, I pulled out their pure ground ribeye burgers for a quick grill session. The flavor and marbling was unreal, rich, juicy, and miles ahead of any average grocery store meat. Try the Burger Perfection Flight at omahasteaks.com today. That's 20 premium steak burgers for just $79.99. Plus, get $35 off with promo code BEEF. That's omahasteaks.com, promo code BEEF for $35 off at checkout. Terms apply. See site for details. I've been trying Underbrush from Nathan and Sons, and it's not really regular gum. It's remineralizing chewing gum, basically an oral care routine in gum form. You brush in the morning and at night, but after lunch, there's a big gap where most of us do nothing for our teeth. Underbrush is made for that moment. Chew it for 5 to 10 minutes, spit it out, and move on. Or keep chewing it if you like the feel of it. It's made with something called hydroxyapatite. That's the same mineral your enamel is made from, and natural saps like mastic and spruce. So it has a firmer, really satisfying chew. The company is only a few years old, and the team is literally making, packing, and shipping gum every day. So if you want a simple daily upgrade for your teeth, check out Underbrush from Nathan and Sons. Check them out today at nathanandsons.com.
So it's more a spot stock environment. That being said, I have a theory, and I've not done this yet, for time constraints, right? I got to be honest, I don't take the Western West Coast hunting as seriously as I take my whitetail hunting.
Okay.
But I have a kind of a theory of, if I can get over some water and find a good crossing, that'll be a good spot for me to flop a tree stand up, right? Mm-hmm. But typically, it's going to be spot and stalk. It's a lot of, I mean, there's jokes about you're kind of in a desert, right? Other than the ocean being here. So everything here wants to kill you. It's either a snake, or it's a scorpion, or it's a bush with thorns that are 5 inches long. Like, everything here wants to poke you or hurt you. So it is spot and stalk. We do see, you know, you're seeing deer out in farm fields and stuff like that, but you're also just keeping an eye on drainages. I would compare it a lot to like mule deer hunting or elk hunting, honestly, as far as that goes.
Are these whitetails or out so there?
It depends on where they fall in the state, but they're either blacktails or mule deer, but they're basically all blacktails. Yeah.
Okay. All right. Cool. Yeah. I mean, when I was up in, we saw a handful of deer in Sonoma. We talked to this one guy, and this is northern, obviously. It's a lot different, but down the entire coast, I know some guys who are north. Smack dab in the middle of San Fran and LA. They're hunting blacktail, but in more of a tree stand environment. A lot of trees and things where they're doing it. And I don't know, can you bait in California? No baiting. Okay. I think some of the other stuff that I saw in some of the other states, like Washington or Oregon, you can bait for blacktail.
Yeah, we'll see with the Oregon thing, right? Because that just came up for a vote on their ballot.
Oh my God.
You're not. Crazy. It's insane because it's not just hunting, it's livestock, husbandry, the whole thing. So, like, all of it.
Yep.
I can't imagine it's going to pass, but the fact that it even made it to the ballot is something we all have to think about, right? Like, that's not a big leap for a lot of states. And it's not just like a state like California, it could be a lot of states out east too.
Yep.
But yeah, so, I actually hunt near Bakersfield, I'd say, high country. That is a rifle hunt we kind of go on every year. It's just like a dude's weekend, right? Mm-hmm. And sometimes you got to have those. That high country blacktail hunt is super fun and super interesting because it is, you're 8,000, 9,000 feet up. People don't think about the mountains here, but there's real mountains. And you're up there, you're around bears, you're around blacktails, and that's fun. I could imagine if you had time to scout it and really get in there, because there's a lot of farm mixed in with that. You get a lot of ag and a lot of you get a lot of grazing rights up there. So you do get some fields and some meadows and stuff like that. I could imagine if you had time to sit down and scout it, run trail cameras, do the whole thing, you could probably pin those deer down just like you could anything else, right?
Yeah.
And tree stand hunt it, and it would probably be successful.
Do you have a lot of other hunters in that area? So like, and the reason
like
I'm
public anywhere else.
Yeah. So, but the reason I'm asking that is where you hunt in California, is it an optic friendly, location where you're able to do a lot of glassing, or do you have to get into the, like in Iowa, right? I can only glass the fields, but I know that if I want to go into the timber and try to find a pinch point or something like that, I got to use a trail camera, or I got to use my boots to get in there and do scouting.
So I would say, it's glass friendly in some ways, and in other ways it's completely not, right? Because the brush here is pretty much impenetrable. It's one of those aspects of, like, I'm sure you've been someplace where you're glassing and you look and you're like, oh, that looks pretty short. And then you get down in it and it is over your head and just like very thick. That's what a lot of it is here. So you can glass certain draws, drainages, things like that, but there's other places, or mountainsides for that matter, like hillsides, you can pick them apart pretty well. But beyond that, once you get down in that stuff, if you're looking down into a drainage, you might see the creek and you might have a couple openings, but there's going to be a lot of spots that you just can't see through, and you have to get down in there. I think if you don't use a little boot leather in that case, you're going to miss a lot of animals.
Gotcha.
And then as you get up into that high country, obviously there's more glassing because it's just bigger. It's more open. But at the same time, I think there's, you know, you hunt a lot of meadows and stuff like that during the day. You're not going to see a ton of deer doing that. They're still crepuscular. It's still the same thing. They're not going to come out until, you know, into those avenues until low light. So you got to be in the woods to hunt them, really.
Yeah. With you doing a lot of travel, especially, like you said, you live on as far as West Coast as you can probably be, and you travel all the way to the Midwest to mainly focus on whitetails. How do you make gear decisions?
So, having done this for a super long time, I've kind of narrowed it down, right? And I am kind of careful because my whitetail gear is sitting at somebody else's house. So I don't want to, my footprint can only be so big, right? So I try to keep it to, like, I'd say the minimums of every category in a lot of ways. And I used to be really bad about this, and I still have way too much at his house. But beyond that, like, I want to be able to have early season clothing that I know, because even during the rut, you hit a 50, 60, 70 degree day during the rut a lot of times, right? Especially in a place like Ohio or something like that. So I keep early season gear because I also go back and I hunt in October in New York. And that hunt tends to be in the 50s and 60s. So early season gear, I keep like a good mid-season set, so to speak. And that's typically what I run during the rut. And then I'll have some colder weather gear. So if I do go back and gun hunt, or we go up to the Adirondacks, because if we do a bit of that and stalk and still hunt and track deer, I'll keep a set that might be set up for that. And then from there, I do have quite a few tree stands and saddles at my cousin's house. And that's just out of necessity, the way we kind of set everything up to do our hunts, right? Mm-hmm. And we're mobile. But a lot of times what's nice in a place we're familiar with is you kind of have some, we walk in the first day, we just burn the first day of that Ohio hunt, and we're hanging some stands in places we know are traditionally good. We might have to adjust them 5 or 10 yards, but then it's just like, it's already there. You're already working hard enough. We're a mile and a half back in a swamp or something like that. It's like, okay, let's get that done. And then I keep one set to be completely mobile, and that goes in and out with me. Oh, I got a hunch, or I saw a deer, or I saw a crossing, or, you know, I think the spot might be good and I didn't go in there to hang a set. I'll go that route about it. But as far as, I've trimmed it way down. And I try and keep it, like I said, just seasonal. And I might carry some rain gear with me, and I might carry one set of, like, kind of, I don't want to say do all, but like a mid season layer set other than the first set. And that's what I carry, 2 pairs of boots. And that's what I bring with me. And then, like, yeah, I said, optics, weapon, and boots. Those are the super important things.
Okay. And so when you go on there, I'm interested in this day one mentality where day one is just going in. So you're pulling all your tree stands down every year, and then you're going back in at the beginning of whatever trip you're on, and you're setting them all back up. And so walk me through a little bit. Are these all hang-ons? Are they all climbing sticks? Or are you pulling ladder stands in?
No, it's all hang-ons. So at this point, it's all XOP stuff. I fly Rubicon, Vanish, and I'll probably end up with another Rubicon set this year, whatever. What I will do is I'll use one of those, kind of goes in deep into, like, this, for instance, we're going to use Ohio, the swamp that we hunt. It goes in deep and it kind of stays there for that week. If I hunt it once or I hunt it 10 times, it's going to stay in that swamp until I'm ready to pull it out, type of deal. And then from there, the fly and the Rubicon kind of rotate through areas. But what we do is first day we're both doing that, and we hunt not terribly far from each other. So we're able to, like, park in the same spot and kind of address it like that.
Okay.
But we'll drive in, we'll get there in the morning. Our Airbnb normally opens up in the afternoon, and we're driving around, we're scouting, we're checking fields to see what crop rotation is, because that really matters in the area we're in.
Yep.
And we're hunting public, and we're putting up some stands and just checking our traditional spots and then seeing if we find anything new. We'll burn the whole first day doing that stuff, get into camp. And then typically that next morning, we're not diving right into a stand. We're normally hunting from the ground, both of us, in the morning, and kind of seeing what's up, because you're able to see a lot that time of year of what the movement looks like.
Yeah.
And sort of in-season scouting in deep with that, and then making all our adjustments from there. So, like I said, it just because we're hanging it, we have a good idea, doesn't mean it's permanent. It can move at the drop of a hat, and we always both always have a set to carry with us. But we're using sticks and stands, and I hunt hybrid at this point, so I'm wearing my saddle the entire time. So I also carry a saddle platform with a set of sticks to put up somewhere, because there are moves where that's just better.
And from a mobile standpoint, man, I'll tell you this, I used to be a skeptic of the saddle, but I wear it every hunt now. I wear it in the, you know, even though I'm going to a permanent set, basically, or a rut set that I know I'm in a good pinch point, deer are going to come through there, and I'm going to have a opportunity at something if I put my time in these, and I'm not being mobile at that point, but I'm wearing a saddle, right? And the saddle allows me to do a little bit more in the stands as far as being comfortable is concerned. The other thing is, if I know that I need to go through a certain point at a certain time, as far as access route, that's when I'm using my saddle, and I am getting ultra mobile, and I know I'm not going to be there for a long period of time, maybe 3 hours or something like that. Anything else, I'm probably going to bring a hang on stand, but from a saddle standpoint, those are going to be shorter hunts for me.
Yeah, that totally makes sense. Yeah. So I jumped in the saddle. This is like back in the day, so to speak. I worked big box. So I remember when the first trophy lines came out, like in 2006, 7, 8, and they were in our stores and people could not wrap their heads around what they were, right?
Yeah.
And what about 2016, you started to hear people kind of talk about it again. And I ended up building a saddle from like a sit drag, and I hunted out of that for like a year, kind of on its own. And then eventually I ended up going to a trophy line via a relationship with them. And then since they changed hands and there was some movement there, the guys from XOP have been great, kind enough to chat with me, and I work with them now. And their saddles, that Mutant is awesome. It's as good as anything I've ever used. But with that, I went from a point of being all saddle all the time to like, I always wear my saddle now, but mostly I'm hunting out of a stand and I'm hybrid and able to take advantage of everything you can do with a saddle.
Yeah.
But also able to sit down if I have to. And I think a chunk of that was, you know, 5'10", 185, 90 pounds, something like that now. But when I started this, I was like 5'10" and like 150 pounds. So a climbing stand was this much bigger than I am as I'm walking. It's way bigger than I am as I'm walking through pinch points and brush and all that stuff. And it's not that they don't have their application, because there's, you know, some limited use for me. But at the same time, it's like, dude, I can sneak into places with a saddle on pretty easy. And the same thing, you know, you get into some of these really light stands, you can definitely do the same with that. But I think to your point, there's a really great application for them in that case, where it's like, I got to get in here and it's going to be, I'm either going to see them in the first 3 hours of daylight or the last 3 hours of daylight, and I'm going to sit there. That's a great application for a saddle, I think.
Yep, absolutely. Now, I don't know why, but XOP, just from, you know, your interactions with your friends, social media, maybe articles. I do a lot of interviews, you know, not only on the Hunting Gear podcast, but on the Nine Finger Chronicles side of things. And the brand XOP just seems to be trending up right now. For a while there, they were doing okay, and they were just another brand on the, another tree stand brand. And there were some other brands that were kind of the peak. But dude, I just hear people talk about XOP all the time now. And it just tells me that if that kind of thing is happening, then that brand is providing a product that people are using and they like.
Yeah. I would love to, you know, tell you some integral piece to my writing for them, but it's not. that's a happy accident, so to speak. But I can only speak to what I've used of theirs, and I used some of their products before I was with them, and that was kind of what initiated me. I won't work with somebody who I haven't dealt with their stuff before. It's just not like within my realm of something I want to do.
Right.
But, dude, their sticks are awesome. They grab the tree super well. I think initially when I messaged you, it was about those X2s, because I'll be honest, man, like I pull the straps off and they're stuck to the tree. And, I've used them versus other stuff, cause I have access to a lot of things and a lot of family members that hunt. So we kind of trade off with different stuff sometimes, and super impressed with that. But they build a really good product for a really good price point, and they're pretty innovative in the way they're, you know, doing things. They listen to their customer base too, which is super important. It's a lot of companies are led, and I think it's important to have visionary leadership, but they're led from the top and then everybody's expected to kind of fall in line. And I think there's a real space there for somebody who says, hey, we'd like to see all these things. And that XOP steps in and says, this is what we're delivering for you guys because you've mentioned these, you know?
Right. Right. Well, here's the deal. Like the Hydros, the X2s and the X3s, I'll tell you this, the original climbing stick that looks like the old Lone Wolf's, but it has the different actual step with the curve on it. I was really intrigued in those when those first came out. I never did ever get a set of them because I had so many sets of the original Lone Wolf sticks. But with my knee, and I've mentioned this before, with my knee and getting older and just putting myself in some very awkward trees, these double step sticks have become more intriguing to me the older I get. I still feel like I would be mobile enough to do all the same things that I could do with my old sticks, but now just have a step on each side and make me more comfortable.
I totally agree. You know, I came from just like you, I've done this a long time. So it's one step on, you know, every other side.
Yep.
And I think you had a dude on recently who was talking about like setting it up and realizing that you put it up incorrectly for the lean of the tree or whatever.
Right.
That happened to all of us, the whole thing. Well, first of all, that never happens when you have double steps. Mm-hmm. I was always concerned about the profile. Like I said, I wanted everything folded up in line as tight as I could get it. And I'm like, oh, if you have two sets of two steps sticking out, there's more to grab onto. I've never had an issue with that. And there's something, they're just more rigid, right? Like you can just feel the quality when you're stepping up on a step. And that could be anybody's two steps, really. But yeah. I really like those X2s. The Hydros are super nice and I like them a lot. They tend to get a lot of my truly, like, I got to go in deep. I'm going to take that fly in that Hydro. They weigh nothing and they lock together well and they're really well thought out. And they're no noise to put up because of the rope system on them. But as far as just like a general set of sticks, that X2, and it could be a stick like an X2, but those double steps are really nice. I like the little up creep they have on the end, like the neural end, so you don't slide off with it. And the other thing is kind of when you're setting, and I'm sure everybody deals with this, and you're on a set of sticks and you're setting, if you're able to put both your feet on top on one stick use that whole, you know, two steps to put your foot on, that makes setting a stand so much easier.
100%.
More space, more room for error on that.
100%.
Yep. So I think those are all, you know, big bonuses to a two-step rather than a single-step stick.
Yeah. One thing that popped up in my head is you live in San Diego. When mm-hmm. I envision San Diego, I envision a lot of people and a lot of houses. Okay. Mm-hmm. But you're a bow hunter. I'm kind of curious where you shoot your bow for practicing with your weapon.
So we moved here about 3.5 years ago. And one of the prerequisites of every house we look at is I have to have at least 20 yards to shoot a bow in the backyard.
Okay.
I have to have at least 20 yards. Yep. But then from there, there's a great archery shop here in San Diego. But beyond that, there's also a killer 3D course at one of our sort of public, well-known public parks. So people know the San Diego Zoo is world renowned, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
About 2 minutes from that zoo, there's a killer 3D course that exists there. And then at a couple of our local parks, like county parks or town parks, there's actual archery ranges just built in. You can go use them for free anytime.
That's crazy to me. Like, I associate archery with hunting, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so, but I also forget that archery is also a very popular thing across the entire world, right? Just archery. You don't have to kill something with it, just archery. And so, I'm so closely into this space that I only, if it's archery, it's bow hunting, but that's not what, like some people just shoot bows for fun, right?
Yep.
And so in my mind, there's a disconnect with all of that, right? And so, you know, you say that and I'm like, God, there's really an archery shop in San Diego, or there's actually a 3D course in San Diego, or, you know, people are shooting bows for, you know, just because they are shooting bows. Like there's no connection to the hunting space. So I don't know. That's just something that I have to pull my brain apart to understand sometimes.
So about 20 minutes from my house, I have like a full 100-yard archery range with like targets every 10 yards sort of thing. And I go shoot there, and 9 times out of 10, I'm the only person shooting a hunting rig. But I'll show up and there'll just be somebody on their lunch break with a recurve like that they bought at whatever big box store, and they're just flinging arrows. They don't really care what they're hitting.
Right.
And then, you know, there's some pretty big YouTube personalities there from the San Diego area that are on that. You would, I mean, they shoot that 3D course pretty often, and they're out there doing their thing. There's a pretty pervasive archery community here in San Diego. And like you said, think about it. Like, you may or may not know this, but South Korea is killer at archery. Like they crush us in most of the world events, and, no hunting in Korea. Like that's right. Just straight archery. Right. So it is pretty big around the world.
Yep. Crazy. So with that said, then, are you going to those locations to shoot your bow, or are you just popping out the back door with your bow and just putting your reps in there?
I put most of my reps in out the back door. I just set up 3D, you know, I'll go from square target, whether it's a block or a bag or whatever, to a 3D target at some point. And then typically I have like a, you know, like a quantity, a number I want to hit of arrows at a 3D target by the time I leave for my first hunt. And I try to do that. Depends on my shoulders. You know, I wrestled for years, so sometimes my shoulders will flare up a little bit.
Worth it. Worth it.
Yep. Oh, dude. Well, I gotta be honest. There's a wrestling club here. Yeah. I'm almost 44. And I started to go and, I'd either, you know, get them good and hip toss them, or I'd get dog walked by some of these 20-year-old kids. And, I loved it. But at some point I talked to my cousin, not the one I've been talking about, but we're super close, and he's done a lot of traveling, not travel hunting. Yeah. But, anyway, I texted him and he's a pretty major athlete. And I was like, dude, this is killing my shoulders. Mm. I think I got to give up wrestling so I don't mess up bow hunting. He's like, yeah. I don't do anything that messes up bow hunting at this point. So
yeah,
I mean, that's within like the past 6 months that decision has been made. Cause I started shooting it just like this pain in my rotator cuff. And I was like, I'm 44. What do I have to prove other than myself? Right. I already know, like, it's fun. I love wrestling, but it's one of those things of like, I'm not willing to give up deer season for it.
Yeah. So let the young dogs do that. Right.
Yeah.
Although I will say this, one of my favorite little things to watch on YouTube. Have you ever heard of the Matt Return?
Yeah.
Where it's all these old dudes coming back on like wrestling. And when I mean old, I mean in their 70s, and they have to have oxygen in between rounds so they can keep going. Like I love watching that shit.
Yeah. It's super fun. And if I could go without like my body really hurting after, I would do it still. Which I think you have to be the right kind of, you got to have the right kind of tism to have wrestling be fun, but it is fun. If you did it long enough, it's fun. Yep. So it's worth it to a point, but once my shoulder started to really bother me where it was like detrimental to shooting a bow, I was like, I gotta pull back on this.
That's why I stopped boxing because of my shoulders. And cause I knew that, any outside reps in my backyard with my bow was just like, when I got to full draw, it was okay. But from drawing back to the point of full draw, I'd have my shoulder start to hurt. And I'm just like, dude, I don't want to ruin this. And to the point where now I'm going to bump down to 65 pounds. So, what kind of targets do you use by chance for your backyard?
So I just, you know, I go to whatever Bass Pro Shops, whatever, and get a bag target, right?
Yep.
Typical bag target. I have a Reinhardt, one of their little triangle style targets. And then I use it, whatever 3D, like right now it's just a shooter buck. I blow the core out on those things. Luckily I've gotten to the point that I'm not a great shot on real deer, but I've gotten to the point on targets, I can keep it within the core of the target and just have to replace that for the most part every year. You know, so that's not as bad a thing. And what's nice about the weather in San Diego is I'm not worried about it getting ruined sitting outside. Right.
It's
72 sunny every day. So,
I've done this thing, in the past when I had, Reinhardt sent me some targets to mess around with. And one guy reaches out to me. He goes, "Hey dude, you gotta spray water repellent on the backs of your 3D targets." And I'm like, "What? I thought they were supposed to be waterproof." Well, over time that waterproofing fades away. And he's like, "Dude, anytime it's dry out, you spray down your target with this like, water repellent, type of sealant, and it expands the life of your targets." And so I'm like, done. You know, that's a very small purchase to the lights, but there's other targets where like, I don't even want to say the brand because I'll never buy it again, but they had a core and I shot the core out. But then the part that held the core in like snapped. So then the core didn't even, when I went to rotate the core, it didn't even stay in anymore. And I was having to use screws to hold the 3D target together, and it was dog shit, and I'll never buy it again. And they had, It was one of those things where they had one opportunity. I gave this, you know, I spent like $220 on it. I gave it one opportunity. It did not cut it for me. And so I'm never going to buy that brand again, which brings me to the question. When do you upgrade or change brands, or how many times do you give a thing an opportunity to work before you're like, "Dude, I'm done with this"?
Probably in my past, way too many.
Yeah.
But I've gotten to the point where I drill down on something that I like, and that is all I will buy. And I don't care if it's like,
yeah.
So at one point I was using a site that somebody asked me to use. Mm-hmm. And I took it on a travel hunt and I shot it the first day and it was like way off. I could hear it rattling. And, you know, it's one of those things where I reach out and I was like, hey, this is happening. And their answer was like, I mean, I fixed it. I tightened it all back up. I did marks. I shot, got my sight, got sighted back in and did the whole thing. But it's like, dude, this is my first day of my hunt. Mm-hmm. I just flew across country. This thing shouldn't be doing, I understand they're rough on your luggage, but it shouldn't be doing this where it was, where it was rattling. And that was kind of like, I went away from that site to another one of their sites and still like the fitment and finish wasn't great and all that stuff. And to me, I'm not like a big, I don't care what stuff looks like really. I care how it performs. And to me, that was it. So I had always been a fan of black gold sights. And that was the first site I ever spent real money on in like 2013 or 2014. Mm. Basically, that's all I use at this point. And I'm not saying there's not other great sights out there, but I've switched back to them and I use the same. So I have two bows. One is like a flagship bow from a few years ago. The other is like a mid-range bow of the same company. So they're very similar and they're set up almost identically. And when I find something that I like, I just get the same thing over and over again. As long as it's performed once, it like, well, I'm going to keep it. And there's no reason for me to replace it at this point. And
dude, I'm the same way. Don't get me wrong. I like, if something really grabs my attention, I'm going to go out and tinker with it. But like my arrow setups, they have not changed in a long time, and I'm going to continue to shoot the, for my whitetail setup, I'm going to shoot a 520 grain arrow with my Wasp jackhammer on the front end, followed by my day six arrow, followed by four fletches. And that's it every single year. That's what I'm going to do. So, they work. I'm confident in them. And so the same thing with like my release, the same thing with my rest. Most of the times whenever I get a new bow, and it's been a while, my sight and my rest are coming over to that.
So I do the exact same. I shoot a Hamsky rest. I won't probably ever shoot anything different. Shoot a black gold sight. And then I'm just basic gold tip hunters with a 50 grain insert in them, and I'll change the fletchings up every once in a while just for fun, for testing. You know, I make sure it's the same for the season, whatever, with a wrap. But I shoot those, and occasionally I'll change up, try some different broadheads. I'm pretty much Grim Reaper all the time at this point, and that's kind of how I roll, and it's been that way for years. So I have dozens and dozens of arrows because I build my own arrows. So it's just one of those things that like, I'm the type that I will buy a new dozen every year and then hunt with, keep six for like hunting season, keep six as backups. And then I just shoot all the other ones that are cut to the exact same length with the exact same components for years. You know what I mean?
Yep. 100%. Rotation. I don't know. Here, dude, you mentioned rests and I've never had a Hamskia.
Hamsky. Yep.
Hamsky. I've never had a Hamsky rest on. I've never used it, so I don't know nothing about them. But you mentioned rests. And I will say this. I used to be a nut job about my rests, my arrow rests. Mm-hmm. And I used, oh my God, I cannot believe I'm blanking on this. Code Red.
Ripcord.
Dude, I used Ripcord and I beat the shit out of my Ripcords. Yep. Okay. Ripcords, badass, awesome rests. Then the company sold. Then something changed with them. And I was like, dude, what's going on here? Call the company. The same people aren't answering the phone. They don't work there anymore. They got bought and sold. Things changed. Product lines changed. Durability changed. And I'm like, dude, I got to look for something else. And I went to a company called Vapor Trail Arrow Rest. I went from, and then the guy who I know, he was like, dude, you got to give the limb driven system a try. And I'll tell you a product that I will continue to shoot until something like that happens again is Vapor Trail Arrow Rest. Dude, zero problems ever, even when you beat the shit out of them. And so if that Hamsky ever gives you problems or you're wanting to, dude, from one bow hunter to the next, dude, check out those Arrow Rests, man. They're badass.
So I will say if I was ever going to go from a Hamsky, I would go to a Vapor Trail because I know multiple guys that I trust that shoot vapor trail. Same thing with Hamsky, right? Like they're both limb driven. They're both pretty bulletproof. I've taken this thing all over the place. I've never had an issue with it, but there's a lot of major rests that I've shot. I'll tell you, I've been in at least peripherally, you know, when I worked big box retail, I've been doing that since I was 18 years old is when I started. So it would have been like 2000. Mm-hmm. So I remember the original Whisker Biscuit, like coming out where people like the original packaging, it came from Carolina Archery, I think it was, or whatever. Mm-hmm. Like I remember that. I've dealt with all that stuff for a long time. But man, once I've shot every drop away at some point or another, and much to your point, when they get sold, the quality just goes down and they'll stick up and they're tough. I think for me, I get pretty intense on tuning and a limb driven just seems to be the way to go for me. Cable driven just
it's too sloppy for some reason.
I've never gotten them to tune exactly the way I want to tune them. Yep. And that could be for lack of education or trying. Mm-hmm. It's not for lack of trying. It could be for lack of education on my part. It's not for lack of trying. Yep. But, you know, I've had them stick up and stuff, too, in super cold weather. And, you know, growing up in Syracuse and hunting in that area, people hear about Buffalo because it's a bigger city. Syracuse gets way more snow than Buffalo, typically. And it's, you know, Buffalo might be a little colder, but not much. Yeah. So, you know, you're hunting in the snow. Used to be 50% of the time you were hunting, you know, during the bow season, archery season. So everything fell on me in that kind of weather. But Hansky's just been great the whole time. So, but my buddies all shoot vapor, not all, but a lot of them shoot those vapor trails. And that's what I would go to if I wasn't shooting a ham.
So it's crazy because like the vapor trail badass, and I put a lot of thought into it and then it turns out good. But then I go to my methodology for my site is different because my site is I want this to be easy. I want my setup to be easy, which is why I use a Trophy Ridge React so that I only have to really do major fine tuning, right?
Yep.
And on the, you know, you set up the 20, you set up the 30, and then the 40, 50, 60, that's what's on my rest, is already set. And so that to me is a no-brainer from a time standpoint, which is different because I don't give a shit how much time it takes to install a rest and for it me to tune that as opposed to getting my sight on. It's like, let's get her done. Right. Like, I don't know why I think that way, but that's why I made that decision and how I make that decision on my sight.
That's interesting. Cause I go pretty much the rest route for everything. So I'll go ahead and make sure all the access to their level and I have the equipment to do that. And I have like a full rig bow shop at my house. So I do all that. But what I found, at least for me, is I'll be the first one to tell you, I still have a tough time with buck fever at times. Like I really do. And I've shot over, under, around, I've hit sticks, I've done everything. I should have just a wall full of big bucks and I don't. And that's on me, right?
Yep.
So what I've kind of done, and I took this from your buddy Tony Peterson, is like simplify it, right? So I shoot a single end, black gold sight on both my bows, and I can move it. So it's a movable, slideable sight. But I leave it at like 25 yards and from zero to about 40. So like really 37, 38, it's going to be where I need it to be because I just needed to get out of the headspace of using multiple pins.
Yeah.
I just line it up and line up the housing in my peep sight, put the pin on it, and hopefully everything works out. And just trying to work on that confidence level. And then also that is why I switched to a 3D target halfway through the year, right? Like let's get used to shooting that silhouette from multiple angles and multiple places. And I think that really matters. But I would love to shoot multiple pins if I thought I could, but I tend to always guess long in the heat of the moment. I use range finding binoculars and we have all the stuff, but let's face it, there's times in whitetail hunting where it happens way faster than that,
and so I've always thought that and every time I have this conversation somebody says to me, oh, get one of the hybrids, right? Get your where your 20 and 30 are solid and then the bottom pin is your 40 through 70 or whatever you have it set up for, right? And then you can crank the bottom pin all the way down. And so, yeah, that's great. But I've shot single pin in the past and I was very happy with it when I could see the game, the animal first, and then range where I thought they were coming through and then make the adjustment. Until one year I had a buck chasing a doe and he was at 30, then he was at 10, then he was at 25, then he was at all these different angles. And I didn't feel confident like putting one pin at 25 yards on all of those different marks, you know, and saying like, oh shit, I should. And that's why I personally feel more comfortable shooting gaps. And just putting like, okay, he's at 25. I'm going to put the 30 on his belly and then pull the trigger, or on his brisket, and then pull the trigger. And that's always worked better for me, I guess.
Dude, that's awesome if you can do it, because you're a better man than I am in that case. Because the second I start gapping something is the second I miss, for sure. I've never shot a gap where I've actually hit where I was shooting, because it is always one of those things where it's a buck chasing a doe or something like that coming through cover, and I have an opening, and I think that opening, you know, it'll be the one opening I didn't range, or I'll have a brain fart and think that opening's 32 and it's actually 22 and I'm right over his back. Right. So it's one of those things of I have to be cognizant of like keeping myself on, you know, within my own devices. Like, I will always, I can take my bow out and shoot 100 yards right now, pretty much no problem, right?
Yeah.
I think I'm going to start limiting myself to about 35 and in, period. Yeah. Like, that's really it. And I do set up for that now more than I used to. I used to set up so I could see. Yeah. Now I set up so I might be able to see him coming, but I want to be in close when I'm taking that shot.
Right. Absolutely. How often do you change your bow?
Shooting a 2022 PSE Omen right now. Mm-hmm. So... 5-6 years maybe. I'm not Mr. Needs One every year. And I, you know, kind of like you, I probably work in a space where I could get one every year, but it's just one of those, I get comfortable. My bow, I know what it does. I have a chrono. I know how fast it goes. I know my exact arrow setup. Mm-hmm. I know the speed. I know the arc. I know where that arrow is going to go. So I just kind of keep it the same, man.
Yeah.
Unless I see something revolutionary come along, it's really tough for me to go out and drop another 1500 hours to get set up at this point for something that I think is that much better.
Dude, I'm telling you, something happened. I don't know if they hired a new guy at PSE back in the day. Like, I don't even know how many years ago was it, but man, I used to think that PSE was a joke. Like of an archery, of a bow brand. And I'm like, who is shooting these bows? Right. And they were even considered popular. And then they went through the speed phase where they'll never see you coming or whatever. They're whatever, you know, just so fast. Like their brace heights were like 1 inches. It like tore your shoulder out just to draw the bow back. But they went 500. Their IBO was 450 or whatever the case is, and something happened, and I don't know what it is, if they had a new marketing guy come in or if they sat down and just said, hey, we got to do something different, in a meeting however many years ago. But that brand has now impressed me from all of the bows that have been coming out of their camp for however many years now, like I'm gonna say five to seven years, something happened, and their bows have become much more shootable, in my opinion.
Yeah. I remember when all those speed bows you're talking about came out, and it would have been about the time of like the Mach Axe and a bunch of those bows. And then, it was probably about 7 years ago. They really changed to like a more shootable. They weren't chasing. Now, a lot of their proprietary systems have great speed behind them because they've worked in that space for a long time, but you're not looking at like 5.5 inch brace heights anymore and stuff. No. And they tended to go pretty short back then, and they still do. They have, you know, a long and short version of everything, just like everybody does now. I think they were really the innovators in that space to build two of the same bow, but in two different lengths. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But I, like you, prefer a longer than 30 inch axle bow. And I think they're super shootable, and the fact that you can kind of order your bows with different cam setups from them to suit you rather than just a super hard pulling cam setup. Yeah. I do remember them having a brutal draw cycle, but man, they were fast.
Fast as shit, and the hand shock after it. So a brutal draw cycle, and then it felt like it was like one of those monk, like you hit the, you take the, what the monks use to make the vibration, to make the calming noise, like, bong, you know, that's what it felt like, but it's different now, man. And so have you always shot a PSE?
No. I have to be honest, my favorite bow I had for a long time, I still have it sitting over in the corner here, it was a Ryterra, which was made by Martin years ago. I've had Matthews, I had a Struthers for a while. That was a great bow. And I know Kevin Struthers always bounced around kind of doing his thing. Mm-hmm. I had a Hoyt way back in the day growing up where I grew up. You had an Oneida Eagle. Everybody had an Oneida Eagle.
Dude, I had an Oneida Eagle.
Everybody had an Oneida Eagle.
My favorite is when you go to pull that bow back in a tree stand and it made so much noise that the deer would just look up at you. The only reason I killed a deer, with a bow like that is because they were dumb Iowa deer. That bow does not fly anywhere else in the country, right? And then
that's plop, really funny.
Like, oh, dude, they were so loud. And then that brand kind of went into the bow fishing space, I think, pretty hard. But I don't know anybody anymore who bow hunts within Oneida.
There's some folks out there I've seen, and man, every once in a while I'll poke on their website and be like, man, I wonder, but it's just like, why would I do that to myself? So that factory originally, like way back in the '80s, early 90s and stuff, was right down the road from Syracuse. It was in Syracuse, basically north of there. So like everybody in our area shot them, but that was back when like Ted Nugent shot, everybody shot them, right? Like that was the thing. And I had one when I started, and then, my uncle had given it to me. I bow hunted with that for a few years. And then it turned out I had it when I lived in North Carolina. Window motor went on my car and I just kind of propped it up and duct taped it from the inside. And somebody saw that, ripped the window down, ripped the bow out of the car while I was at school one day, like in college. And I was, you know, so I shot a Parker for a little bit too, back when they were around. But yeah, I've shot just about everything. I've been PSE for about 4 or 5 years now. And I have no reason to change again until something crazy comes out. I shot a Matthews. I blew that up myself on a press by accident. It was a dumb move, you know, one of those things. But anyway, I have a tough time telling you I'm going to change bows even in the next probably 2 years, unless I see something that I absolutely must have. It's just really tough for me to say.
I used to be that guy who wanted a new bow every year. I was like, oh, dude, I'm just going to get this new bow, set it up, tear it down. Until the last handful of years, I am pretty sure, I know there's going to be some tuning that I have to do and get some muscle memory back into the body, but I'm going to pull my bow up, I'm going to shoot an arrow, and it's going to hit the target. And there's something kind of cool about that, dude. Like, I don't need to tune a whole bunch of shit. I'm just going to, it's there from last year. I'll put my reps in. I'll make my little tunes, but then I'll get back in the tree and feel confident because it's the same setup that I killed my deer with last year.
Well, and to that point, that's exactly it. If you get out there and all of a sudden something goes haywire on the bow that you've had for 5 years, you know, it's the bow went haywire. It's not, am I getting used to this? Is this something the bow is going to do? Do I have to tune this out? Is something up with my sight? You're not going through checking all these boxes, checking 15 things before you get to the root of the problem. You know, sometimes the root of the problem is you, but for the most part, you have something you've been shooting for like 5 years. You can turn around and go, there's something dramatically wrong with this. I can figure this out. Yep. So I do, you know, with all the traveling and stuff, I do just go to whatever the store and I get a silver pen and I mark a silver Sharpie and I mark everything. I mark my rest setup. I mark my sight setup. I mark it on the riser. So in theory, like even on my riser, I have where my 20-yard pin would be as a line on my riser so that I can look. And at least if I had to do something crazy in the field and set it all up or buy a new sight or whatever, I have a starting point. Mm-hmm. And I do the same thing with my arrows. Like, you know, a lot of current bows will have lines kind of like near the burger buttons and on the shelf and stuff like that. And I'll just go ahead and trace everything, where everything is. And then same thing with my cams and any of the positionings on the cams. I make marks for all that stuff because with the traveling and it being on airplanes and stuff like that, I can visually inspect my bow or have a really great reference point if something does right. happen. That is the starting point for that.
Right. Amen. Amen. Well, this has been a great conversation, dude. I appreciate you taking time out of your day to hop on and BS with us a little bit about the hunting gear that you use, how you use it, and how you travel with it. Thank you very much for taking time out of your day, and I look forward to chatting with you again, man.
Yeah, Dan, this is a super pleasure. Thank you so much for inviting me on, man. This is a ton of fun.